On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In Napoleon, North Dakota, the winters are long and cold. The summers are short and hot, and for farm kids, hard. Deborah Marcourt grew up on a third-generation family farm outside Napoleon, steering the tractor from the time she was five, wrestling with boys in the endless wheat fields, dreaming of escape. She's written a beautiful memoir called The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere. It's about farm girls and farm boys and a father caught in a passionate, devastating affair with the family land. It's about breaking away from the work of generations and looking back with a torn heart. She is now coordinator of the creative writing program at Iowa State University. She joins us today from Kalamazoo, Michigan. Deborah Marcourt, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Terrific to have you. As a farm kid myself, I have to say I love this book, and I'll vouch for it. You're further west than me. I was an Illinois farm boy, and I feel a little bit indicted by your description of farm boys in this book. But you're way out there, nearly to the 100th meridian, the one you quote Wallace Stegner describing as an inflexible line of aridity in little tiny Napoleon out by Edgeley and Ashley and far from Bismarck. I wish you'd just begin, if you'd be good enough, by describing the physical world of your youth on the farm there. What did it look like?
Well, North Dakota has a pretty varied landscape, but the part of North Dakota that I grew up in, which is in south central North Dakota, is right on the 100th meridian, as you said. It's a couple degrees shy. And things change, you know, once you get a little west of there, they get drier and life gets a little harder. But it is a kind of arid, austere landscape, not a lot of trees. As people who have driven through it probably know, it's very flat in the eastern part of the state. And some people claim you can even see the curvature of the earth as you're driving. So it's a beautiful place, but it is very austere. And as a child growing up there, I imagined all the other places that I'd like to live in.
Very vividly, and eventually lit out for them. Describe for us what brought your family originally to this part of the world, how they got there, and what the family legacy was by the time you were growing up in the 60s in, as you say, south central North Dakota.
Well, the five-county area that I grew up in North Dakota is called the Sauerkraut Triangle, because it's populated largely by a group of, it's an ethnic enclave, and the people who live there are this sort of not very well-known ethnic group called the Germans from Russia, and they have a very complicated history, but basically my great-grandparents with my grandparents emigrated to the Dakota Territory in about 1885 through 1885 and 1911. Both sides of my family came from the Black Sea region of what was then Russia, and they were really pretty much on the run from political changes that were occurring in the Russian Empire even during those years, you know, prior to the revolution. And so they took up land claims in Dakota Territory and basically carved farms out of the virgin, you know, prairie. And so that was sort of my cultural inheritance, you know. My great-grandfather took up the land claim. My grandfather managed to hold on to it through the Depression and the Dust Bowl days. And then my father, I didn't learn this until much later in my life, but, you know, kind of unwillingly took it over and managed to keep it. That was sort of a thing that we said a lot in my family, never let the land go out of the family.
Your great-grandfather must have been quite something. Within 15 years of immigrating there, had acquired 6,000 acres of the Great Plains. It's partly about family legacy, but it's very intimate as well. And I'd love to hear you read a bit for us, if you'd be good enough, Deborah. Right from the beginning of the prologue. Take us in there, if you'd be good enough, with farm boys and farm girls and your own perceptions as a child.
This is from Pilgrim's Soul, the prologue. Farm boys, how we avoided them when they came around. their hands heavy with horniness, their bodies thick with longing. Be careful of farm boys, we warned each other. They know how to plant seeds. And who could say where their hands had been? On pitchforks, mowers, inside swathers, combines. They were patient boys, those long hours in the saddle of the tractor, plowing dark furrows in the fertile earth. They might be grasping the teats of milk cows at sunrise, killing gophers in the afternoon, and be on you by nightfall. No, no, best to stick with town boys, their soft saliva mouths, their round corduroy shoulders, their talk of plans for college. We were farm girls running tall through pastures. We had long shiny hair and peach-fresh skin, born to carry the milk bucket, the alfalfa bale. Our hands soon mastered the manual transmission. We learned to speed shift, double clutch. Our feet never knew the brake. We roared down the section lines in our father's pickups, empty gas cans clanging in the truck bed. We left trails of dust behind us. This was no little house on the prairie. We smeared musky blue shadow on our eyelids and raspberry glass gloss on our lips. We wore platform shoes and bell-bottom jeans. It was the times. We were hip-huggered and tight-sweatered and navel-exposed. We walked around town like the James gang, tossing this and flashing that. We came in pairs sometimes. First cousins, second cousins, double cousins. It thrilled the imagination. Some were brunette with delicate features. Some had hair that hung heavy as gold down the angle of a jawline. Some of us had wild laughs that never led to wild actions. Some had older sisters who got in trouble and had to get married or had to be sent away to homes for wayward girls. We had strong white teeth. We shone them on the world. We spoke the international language of beauty. All the immigrant grandparents gossiped in German about us. We were wayward girls looking for the untroubled way. We were best in show, the pick of the litter, the cream of the crop, too good for this place, everyone agreed. We were programmed for flight. We farm girls lived north, south, east, and west of town. In the middle of all this was me, the girl that I was then, the watcher, leaning toward the periphery.
Deborah Marquardt, reading from her new book, The Horizontal World. You write about the relationship with family land. You call it painful, satisfying, devastating, all-consuming, the most passionate kind of love affair, and yet you wanted to go. I wish you'd describe for us that tension between the romance and passionate love and the urge to flight.
Yeah, my book is about a kind of ambivalence that covers both ends of the spectrum, not only the sweetness of that relationship with family land and all of the rootedness that it brings me, you know, as I say in the book, sort of cast about rootless in the world. I can do that because I know that that place exists in the world where my family is, and I can go there and people know my name. But I think sort of on the other end of the spectrum is this feeling of being maybe written by the place in a way that I didn't want to be written, you know, that I had an impulse. I think I say in the book I was sort of hijacked by American pop culture, as, you know, so many of us were in the 60s and the 70s, and I wanted to get out in the world and find that world away from the farm. And so I think that those two tensions work. And I didn't really try to argue for one side or the other, but to say that I think they kind of coexist together.
Mm. There's a great description of you first driving your father's tractor in the hayfield. Your brother, you were the youngest of, I think, five, and your brothers and sisters coming along behind and red-faced with anger whenever you jolt the clutch, but then falling asleep that night in bed, still with the vibration of the feeling of the vibration of the tractor steering wheel in your hands and arms. I remember that well. But at the same time, you're out there with the TV on watching the Mary Tyler Moore Show and That Girl and looking out at all of this sort of lush, green, suburban, you know, consumerist American life, kind of 19th century work life and a very 20th century media life. You were in both. It wasn't Little House on the Prairie exactly.
Yeah, I wanted to really try to rewrite some of those cliches about, you know, the Midwest, the Little House on the Prairie cliche and the farmer's daughter cliche. And but I did. I mean, I watched television and I saw Mary Tyler Moore and I saw That Girl and I thought, oh, you know, that could be me. And I loved those high-rise apartments, you know, in like the Bob Newhart Show.
Right. And no cows to milk there.
Yeah, and, you know, getting to ride an elevator and having a butler who would bring you cookies at the end of a day and things like that.
But there you were in the heart of very, very rural country. What were your parents' expectations for you? Did they think you would pick up the mantle of farmer's daughter, farmer's wife?
Well, I think, you know, there is a little empire building that goes on out in those parts that, you know, I mean, it happens sort of naturally, but one just has to look across the section line and see a family that maybe has a farm boy. And then, you know, in my family, there were four girls, so there were a lot of farm girls. And the question was, where would we end up going and where would we find a place in the world? So the most natural conclusion is that we would find a place on one of the other farms with one of the other farm boys. And I think, you know, I sort of fought that. I resisted that. And knew that I would go to college because I had a very strong flight impulse, and I was very rebellious as a youth.
Deborah, I enjoyed reading this so much. I wish you'd read a bit more for our listeners. We're back to farm boys and girls here, but we can't really get away from it in your story. There's a great piece here on the difference between the town kids and the farm kids. I wonder if you'd jump into that for us.
Okay. Sometimes town girls who don't know any better marry farm boys. First, they get all soft and romantic at the sight of those rugged farm boy hands. Then they begin to imagine their idyllic life on the farm. It would be nice to have some animals, the town girls croon, maybe a horse or two. It's a farm girl code not to warn the town girls about the farm boys, about their horny hands and their uncanny ability to plant seeds. It's retribution, a farm girl payback. Town girls had noon lunches at home while farm girls sat on hard school benches eating not-so-hot lunches. Town girls got to be cheerleaders, school newspaper editors, homecoming queens. Farm girls got to milk cows, haul bales, pick rocks. They got to work in the barns and the fields beside their brothers, the farm boys, like equals in the cold winters and hot summers. Each year on the last day of school, the farm girls mounted the steaming row of buses on the curb for the long ride home. They were going far from town now, east, west, north, south, sometimes hour-long bus rides deep into the country. Goodbye, farm girls, the town girls rode by on their banana bikes and waved, not in a mean way, but in a town girl way, oblivious to any hardship around them. See you in 3 months, the town girls sang, thinking about a long summer of picnics and swimming pool afternoons. The farm girls glowered at the town girls through the bus windows, thinking of spreading straw with pitchforks when they got home. The farm girls knew that in the summer, aside from church, they might get to town 3 or 4 times, a few Friday nights, the corn show, maybe the 4th of July. By the end of the summer, they knew their boyfriends would be town girl boyfriends.
Deborah Marcourt reading from her memoir, The Horizontal World. The Chicago Tribune describes your description of that terrain, that culture, desolate, surprising, defeating, liberating, pitiable, gorgeous. We can hear all that. It's, boy, there's plenty of tension built right in.
It's all those things, yeah.
Let me take a call from Buffalo, New York. Eric's calling. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hello.
What do you know, Eric?
My family, my extended family, hails from Iowa. And my folks moved away out of off the farm, but we always went back during the summer, like summer vacation, and you know, for Christmas. And they're really some of the fondest memories I have of my childhood. Mm-hmm.
Did you wish that your family had stayed there, that you were one of those farm boys, or not, Eric?
It was, you know, it was a little of both. But you know, I did enjoy going back to the city. And it was such a nice break just to have all the different sounds and textures of that kind of life.
Great to taste. Deborah, I wish you'd take us in again to that kind of, on the one hand, we've got this sense of, you know, the wonders of the rural life, and you describe the strength of people working there. At the same time, you've got a tremendous out-migration from much of this region, especially the Dakotas on into Montana. Something is driving people away, too.
Yeah, well, it's a lack of opportunity in some cases. You know, it's the economy, things like that. You know, I wanted to thank that caller because I live in Iowa now. It's my adopted state. So
yeah.
I think it's a beautiful place and, you know, a place that just sort of nurtures and sustains me. So when I first moved to Iowa, I thought, oh, it's so green, you know, and compared to North
right,
Dakota, there's
right.
so many trees here, I can't right. see the moon, you know. But the out-migration, I don't know, I kind of have a theory about this. I think all the North Dakotans live in, you know, Iowa and Indiana, and all the Ohioans live in Montana. And so we all ended up somewhere,
mm-hmm.
but... It does seem to be, I know in North Dakota they've, you know, documented it pretty thoroughly that there is a massive out-migration of young people. They lose what they believe to be, you know, some of their most gifted and talented people. That sort of resource goes to other places.
You saw it firsthand, and I know it as well, that life can be fantastic. It can also be hard. You said we had no vacations, no road trips to monumental sites, went to Bismarck twice a year to shop. you had wheat and flax and oats and barley and alfalfa and chickens and eggs and livestock and dairy cattle. You write this sentence that really struck home. Dairy farming is as close as one can come to slavery and still be a technically free person. Describe what you mean by that for us.
Well, you know, you have to milk cows 2 times a day in the morning, usually at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, and then at 5 and 6 o'clock at night. So dairy farmers are limited to travel only a distance that will allow them to return by that, you know, that next milk time.
Right. So the tether is on, and it's on every day.
It is. And my parents had ideas about our milk cows. I said in the book, we weren't allowed to be extravagant or temperamental, but our milk cows were treated like royalty, you know. And so they couldn't be milked by even a distant relative. They had to be milked by us every day.
Right. They had to be just the same stanchion that they were used to, fed grain just the same way. You write, on a farm where survival hangs in the balance, there's no tolerance for tantrums. We children were expected to be well-behaved and hardworking, no room to be moody, temperamental, or high-strung. Yet all manner of extravagance was foisted on our Holsteins.
That's right. And I think that as a creative child, I just sort of searched around for, what would sustain me? What would allow me to find my own voice and my own story sort of inside of that agricultural story?
Did your parents see you searching for that? Did they feel that that search? Did they support it?
Oh, I'm sure they saw it. And, you know, this is, I think, part of the reconciliation that happens in the book, that I really, I began to understand, I suppose, in the way that most people do as they get older, how human my parents were, and that they themselves had gone through this drama of wanting to leave and wanting to move to a city, Bismarck in their case.
In fact, they'd done it for a while. Your father was a salesman in, what was it, a hardware store?
He was. He was a salesman in a hardware store, and he was one of the younger boys in the family. And he just ended up having to take over the farm. He made that decision and that sacrifice to move back and take over the farm, because otherwise it would have gone out of the family.
Your mother knew what that meant. She said it was the worst fight of their marriage the night he announced to her that they were going back. And he wasn't exactly a strapping farmer type.
No, he wasn't. He was kind of delicate, kind of elegant and delicate, like Fred Astaire. He was small. Mm. And my mother was pregnant with me when they had that fight. So I always figured I must have been privy to it.
One way or another.
Way.
Right. So you knew that place had a kind of a challenge wrapped around it. Let me take a call from Lansing, Michigan. Don's on the line. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. What do you know, Don?
Well, I just want to say I'm a town boy from North Dakota.
Do you have that soft saliva that Deborah's writing about?
Yeah.
Fun to kiss?
Absolutely.
Those round corduroy shoulders.
Right.
I also want to say that my very first love of my life was a girl, a farm girl from Napoleon, North Dakota.
Ooh.
So I had to call.
Wow.
It's heating up fast here. Do you remember her name, Don?
Well, I don't know if I want to say her name on the air. Her first name was Audria. She was beautiful.
And did it matter that she was a farm girl? Was it different? Did that attract you somehow, or she was just the girl?
Oh, she was just beautiful. It didn't matter that she was a farm girl. But I remember going to her farm and staying there for several days with her family and, you know, going through the chores with her. And so this is wonderful to hear all of this. I can't wait to read the book.
How did it look to you as a visitor, going out to, you know, for a couple of days to do the chores? Did it look romantic or did it look hard, Don?
Well, it looked pretty hard to me. And I had spent some time in Idaho. My mother had grown up on a farm, so I'd been with my uncles there and knew firsthand that it wasn't for wimps.
You knew it, and you saw it, and it sounds like you kissed a piece of it as well. Thanks for the memory, Don. Thanks very much for calling. Let me get a call from Iowa City. Kim is on the line. Hi, Kim. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. What do you know, Kim?
Well, this is the most providential radio program ever. I am on the last day of my annual pilgrimage to the Great Plains, driving to the airport, back to the airport to head home to North Carolina. And the resonance of the wing and that ache to fly and get away. And I did get away. But out of the world. And what I find every time I come back is that the world comes here. And just this trip, this week in the Great Plains, I got to speak many of the languages that I've learned after leaving the Great Plains. Wow.
Kim, we're losing you out on those Great Plains. I'm sorry to say, but we did hear that when Kim goes home, the world has come to that home, to the Great Plains. That it's not quite what it was. Do you have that experience, Deborah?
Oh yes. You know, I in the last chapter of the book I write about, it's a chapter called Signs and Wonders, and I write about going home and seeing all the changes that have occurred and you know, just tremendous changes. There's wind farming going on, and I just thought, well, that's a great idea, you know, because there's a lot of wind in North Dakota, and although we still are a little off the grid, as we just heard that caller, you know, her
right.
cell phone was going in and out,
right.
but I wanted to say about her call that that enthusiastic response to the book, I've gotten that from so many people, a sort of overwhelming response that somehow the story resonates with them. And I didn't think that my own personal story was as important to the book as sort of folding it into this larger story about, you know, about home and the meaning of home and this idea about whether it is possible to actually go home again, if you can sort of fit back into that spot.
You quote Thomas Wolfe at the beginning, all that he knew was that the years flow by like water and that one day men, and in your case women, come home again. But then you also describe begging your husband, saying, if I ever get sick, please don't send me home to die. You said it as a joke so it didn't sound demented, but you didn't mean it exactly as a joke.
Well, no, I say in that part of the book, I say we it's usually in the middle of the night when I can't sleep and I wake up and I tell him all the things that I'm worried about. And then when I say, don't send me home to die if I ever get sick, we both start laughing because it sounds so demented. But then I say we laugh for different reasons. He laughs because he doesn't have a hillside in North America where, you know, three or four generations of his family are buried. And I do. And then I kind of know that hillside waits for me. And I think that... that's one thing about living in a small town, especially living in an agricultural place, that, you know, you have a very strong sense of the gravity of life and the full spectrum, the full circle, because in small towns, you know, if someone dies, you know that person, you know, usually who their children are, who their parents were, who their grandparents, you know, you know the full spectrum of a story, maybe something like an Icelandic saga, you know, in scope. And when you live in a larger city, I think one tends to lose track of people. We know them for small periods of time, and then they drift off and spin out. And so I think that rural life does lend itself more to those very strong and sometimes claustrophobic connections.
You call that relationship with the land painful, satisfying, devastating, all-consuming, the most passionate kind of love affair. I mean, even... In a way, I don't know what your experience is, but even the dead, I mean, I remember behind the house, you know, there's the tombstone of, I don't know, six or seven generations back, the first grandmother there says the first white woman settler in McLean County. And I remember sort of feeling as though I were growing up among ancestors that had lived on that land for so long. Do you have that sense?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I do. I said in my book that I knew that some of my grandparents had died in the rooms where, you know, I was growing up. Mm-hmm. And I always have a sense, I still do, of them. I have a sense of sort of my six grandfathers all named Joseph Marquardt, you know. Mm-hmm. They go all the way back to Russia, and I sometimes feel like they're sitting on me like a little totem, you know. And I say in the book that there is a moment when I was interviewing my older cousin Tony, who knew a lot about my great-grandfather, and I was sitting at a table with him and my father, and we, all three of us, were using the same gesture with our hands. We had our hands kind of folded.
Yeah.
And I saw how much our hands looked alike, and I had this realization that I'd spent most of my life out in the world with people from all different parts, you know, of the world. And to sit in at a table and see three pairs of hands so much alike made me realize that, you know, my hands were sort of connected to something, that they weren't just free to do as they wished, but that they were bound to do something that connected them to my tribe and my family.
Feeling all those generations. You're right. Growing up, I believed I was surrounded by the most austere, pragmatic, hardworking people. But now I know that we were hopeless romantics when it came to land, the worst sort of high-stakes gamblers, betting the farm, and all our lives, every day, when we went into the fields, success dependent on the weather, the government, the ancient gods of catastrophe, the Chicago Board of Trade, all forces out of our control, yet we persevered. Your brother, at least, was on the farm. Is he still running the farm?
He is, yeah. He resisted as much as possible this, what inevitably was his fate. He had to take over the farm. And I say in the book, he bought a gas station. He worked in a body shop. He played rock and roll guitar. He traveled. He was a custom combiner for a while.
But eventually, custom combiner, I love it.
Yeah. He was out, you know, harvesting the crops of other people while my father was at home, you know, mm-hmm. harvesting his crops. And but eventually he did move back and take over the farm, and he's found a way to do it, you know, in such a way so that his children learned how to swim and they have holidays. And, you know, I mean, these are just different times. So he's tried to make a conscious effort to give them kind of the best of both things, you know.
Mm. Gordon is calling from Augusta, Georgia. Hi, Gordon. You're on the air.
I'm a farm boy from the other side of the fence. I was my father's only son, but my parents supported me going to the University of North Dakota, and I got a degree and was able to travel the world and see things that I never dreamed of seeing.
And how do you look back on it now, Gordon?
Well, at the age where you do look back romantically, and when I do go back, I feel that same draw. But I was wondering if Deborah is able to square that with the monoculturalism in North Dakota, the fact that you aren't going to see museums and other cultures that would expose you to the way the world has been working.
Let us pick it up. Deborah, how about it? You're looking across from Iowa now. Gordon's not so sure it works for him when he goes home anymore.
Yeah, well, I had so much help when I was writing this book from, you know, other writers who had written about these rural childhoods. And Wallace Stegner wrote this great book, Wolf Willow, and he said, I grew up in a dunghill sagebrush town on the disappearing edge of nowhere. Mm. And then he does talk about this, what Gordon's alluding to, that when he went to live in larger cities, he realized that he had friends who had been sort of taking in culture, you know, high culture. I mean, museums, galleries, opera from their earliest years. They had just been sort of breathing it in.
Mm-hmm.
And he realized he had so much to catch up on, so much to make up for. And then I think, you know, eventually Stegner comes back to saying, well, I didn't get that, but I got something else. And he says there were advantages to growing up a sensuous little savage. That was his language. But and again, you know, I think in the book I try to work with the ambivalence of it. You know, to say it wasn't one or the other, but it was sort of both at one time. That, you know, I really love that place and I still do, and I love going back there. But at the same time, I I have that sense of heaviness about my childhood and about that sort of childhood of work on the farm and all the things that we had to do in order to keep the land and the family. So it's a balancing act,
You're
I
right.
think.
This is the place of dust where I spent my childhood, the place that extracted from me the price of one childhood. You know, having lived that life, I don't know, six or seven generations in, I mean, that balance that you describe, you know, on the one hand, it's heavy. On the other hand, I don't know if you had the feeling sometimes you're so deep into it, whether it's all day on the tractor or all day in the fields or all month or, you know, weeks on end, and it's hard, but sometimes you almost feel like you're working directly with God. I mean, it's kind of magnificent at the same time when it's good.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there was this great book that I came upon by Mircea Eliade called The Myth of the Eternal Return, and he talks about agriculture and that when people are, when they're shaping land and when they're really sort of working with it and carving it into this sort of this place that they can make their own, they do feel this connection to ancient patterns and a feeling of resonance overtakes them. And I think that explains to me why my great-grandparents could have, you know, made this farm. We would imagine now that the work would just be impossible, but they did just tremendous amounts of work with just a few people. And I think that's because they were driven by this feeling of connection to sort of ancient patterns, and you know, they really felt the importance of it.
Gravity seems to pull stronger in Logan County, your home county, you're right. Terry's calling from Idaho Falls, Idaho. Hi, Terry, you're on the air.
Hey, you know, my dad was an escapee, a farm boy escapee, and the story goes that he threw a coin with another farm boy to find out if they were going to Florida or to California. California won. They were going as far away from southern Minnesota as possible. But I found it really interesting that my entire childhood, every August, we went back for 3 weeks, and he fixed things. I picture him in my mind. He's on the ladder at the top of the barn fixing the roof.
Yeah.
And we never took a real vacation. We only went back to the farm, drove my mother crazy, and because she didn't want to work. She wanted to have a break, you know.
Right.
But that's what we did every single year. It was a real obligation.
He escaped, but yet he went right back. And it's you're right, Deborah. I have lived in places where gravity pulls less on me, mostly college towns and other states. But no matter how far I travel, no matter how magnificent my flight, I fear this place will become jealous of my wandering and claim me as its own. Sounds in the same vein.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that that pattern that the last caller was talking about, you know, it's almost like it imprints on agricultural children. I know, you know, even though I've been fleeing farm life my whole life. As it turns out, everywhere I end up, as soon as I get there, I start pruning and shaping my environment, you know, turning it into the North 40,
right.
You know. And
right.
I even sort of had this realization that that writing is a little bit like farming because, you know, when you farm, you work in these even rows of crops.
Mm-hmm.
And when you write, you create these even rows of text, you know. So I realized I've been sort of farming my whole life.
All those plow furrows of the mind still rolling across
That's
the
right.
page. That's great. Kathy's calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to say that it's not just folks who grew up on a farm who can get mm-hmm. seduced by the beauty of the land.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago and moved to rural Wisconsin and met a neighbor farm boy and fell in love with him and with his family's land. And when the marriage fell apart, I had a harder time leaving the land than I had leaving my husband and the life that we had together. He was a dairy farmer. And we rarely saw each other. He was working for his parents and not earning any money. I had to work off the farm so that we had some actual cash to buy groceries with and things like that.
And what did you feel you lost in that loss of the land? I mean, the marriage is one thing, but you're putting the loss of the land and your relationship with Hire. What was that exactly?
I'm not sure. I wish I knew. It's mm-hmm. been a good 20 years since the marriage broke up, and I still don't quite understand why the land had such a hold on me. Maybe it was just the sheer beauty of it.
Did you feel suckered finally by marrying the farmer? That's what the farm girl said. They wanted town girls to do a kind of soft revenge.
Well, some of those farm boys can be very, very, gorgeous. So.
Oh, he was gorgeous. And off the farm, he was absolutely charming. Unfortunately, on the farm, under the pressure of all the work that needed to be done and how little money there was to, you know, help out with getting things done, he was a different person, and he was physically and verbally abusive. It was very difficult.
Kathy, we appreciate the story. It's a great glimpse of something that Deborah's writing straight to. Let me get another call, if I may, from Duxbury, Massachusetts. Mona is on the line. Hi, Mona. You're on the air.
Yes. I'm a wife of 57 years, and 57 years ago I was married in Fargo, North Dakota.
All right. Good.
To a Parisian gentleman. We do go back, but I have no regrets. When I was 4 or 5 years old, I realized that there were two trains that came through Fargo, the Northern Pacific and Great Northern. They were at each end of Broadway, and it was always exciting to see them come through because I knew that very soon, someday, I would get on one of those trains and leave, which I did at age 16.
And off to the gentleman from Paris and not looking back. Mona, thank you for that. Let me get one more. Tim's calling from Asheville, North Carolina. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hello. I grew up in the city of Mitchell, South Dakota, and grew up in a medical family and thought that I would follow my father's practice, and I went away to college, went to an Ivy League school as a token South Dakotan, lasted for a year, and was pulled back to South Dakota, finished my education there, but then rather than go on into medicine, I got a PhD in chemistry, and that took me other places.
Do people still expect you to come home?
They do. Every time I'd come back for a reunion, say my 10-year reunion, they'd say, well, we understand you're a doctor. And I said, well, yeah, I am, but not a medical doctor. Well, are you still coming back to take over your father's practice?
So come on home. Our time is short, but let me put that to Deborah. Are you still expected to come home, come back, Deborah Marquardt?
Oh, all the time, yeah. And I do. I try to get home at least now, at this point, once a year and more if possible. And I tell the story in my book that one time I went home and my sister manages a local bar, and there was a guy sitting at the bar, and he said, you're one of the Marquardt girls, aren't you? And then I said, yeah. And he was trying to figure out which of the four I was. And then finally he said, aren't you the one who was in college for so long? And I said, yeah, that was me. And then he said, you must have been really stupid that you had to stay in school for so long.
I love it.
So in the book I say that's the way it is. The dumb kids, you know, get sent away and the smart kids stay, because it really takes some of the strongest people.
You know,
we've
had just an ocean of callers this hour. You really clearly tap a vein with this. And I've got to mention, you close the book with an 11-page farmer's daughter joke, which is just hilarious, turns the whole genre on its head. But there's a question I have to ask you. I guess I think about it myself. You get drawn back there. You described the hillside of the bone with the bones of your ancestors. Do you think about where you will be buried? And do you think it will be with them there?
I do think about it, you know, because my father is now buried in that hill, and I don't really have an answer to that yet. You know, fire is a big element of mine, so I'm thinking maybe if I just get cremated, that'll solve all the problems. I get spread, maybe on an island in Greece or something, but I don't know the answer to that question yet. I'm still working that out.
And your guess? An island in Greece or Logan County, Napoleon, North Dakota? Up in the air.
Maybe I could divide myself, you know, and put some, in Napoleon and some in, you know, on the island of Mykonos or something.
Right, right.
But I do think for me now, it's really meaningful to have a place to go, you know. I feel my father's presence, even though he's been dead now for 10 years, is still, I just feel his presence all the time. And I talk in the book about, you know, I find these dimes all the time. And I always feel like, I know it sounds crazy, but it's like a little message from him. And so I always feel like it's nice to know that there's a place where he is and where I could go and see him and my grandparents and my great-grandparents. So I have to work that one out. I hope I have a little time to do that.
We hope you have plenty of time, and we look forward to reading more. It's been wonderful talking with you today. Deborah Marquardt, author of The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Tom.
We end this hour with a quiet song of the farm, read by one of America's great modern poets. Ted Kooser was born in 1939 in Ames, Iowa. He spent most of his life in the heartland, first in Iowa and now near Garland, Nebraska, population 247. Kooser is author of 10 collections of poetry, including the Pulitzer Prize-winning Delights and Shadows. From 2004 to June this year, he was Poet Laureate of the United States. Rural life and wide open spaces are much of the inspiration for Kooser's verse, including the simple melancholy of his 1980 poem, Abandoned Farmhouse. He reads it here.
He was a big man, says the size of his shoes on a pile of broken dishes by the house. A tall man, too, says the length of the bed in an upstairs room. And a good, God-fearing man, says the Bible with a broken back on the floor below the window, dusty with sun. But not a man for farming, say the fields cluttered with boulders and the leaky barn. A woman lived with him, says the bedroom wall papered with lilacs and the kitchen shelves covered with oilcloth. And they had a child, says the sandbox made from a tractor tire. Money was scarce, say the jars of plum preserves and canned tomatoes sealed in the cellar hole. And the winter's cold, say the rags in the window frames. It was lonely here, says the narrow country road. Something went wrong, says the empty house and the weed-choked yard. Stones in the field say he was not a farmer. The still sealed jars in the cellar say she left in a nervous haste, and the child, its toys are strewn in the yard like branches after a storm, a rubber cow, a rusty tractor with a broken plow, a doll in overalls. Something went wrong, they say.
American Poet Laureate Ted Kooser reading his poem Abandoned Farmhouse. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Time was falling down and winter was closing in. Now the warriors of winter, they give a cold triumphant shout.